Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And welcome back. It is Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I got to tell you, we've got a real technology bent that's going on today. And from announcements to guests, in fact, our first guest coming up in about 8 minutes, Thomas McKenty from Chicago. He's with High Definition Genealogy. He has got his future goggles on and is going to tell you some amazing things about some technology that's going to be coming down the line in the next 5 to 10 years. And if it doesn't sound like the Jetsons to you, well, it sure does to me. It's going to be interesting stuff. Then later in the show, from Raynham, Massachusetts, we're going to talk to Catherine Jackson. Now, Catherine's mother was born in Ireland, moved to Massachusetts, married, had Catherine, and then died when Catherine was only 8 years old. And she wanted to find out things about her, learned that mom had falsified documents concerning her birth, that mom had traveled the world. So she went about a decades-long search that you are not going to believe. It involved DNA. It involved radio appearances and posts on websites back when the internet first came up. And finally, a big payday. And wait till you hear how all this resolved itself. It's great stuff later in the show. But right now, once again, from the New England Historic Genealogical Society, it's my good friend, the chief genealogist, David Allen Lambert. Hi, David. How are you?
Hey, Fisher. How are you?
Oh, well, I tell you, you've got a lot of news. We've got a lot of big news this week. And starting with our friends at MyHeritage, one of the sponsors of this show. And, you know, we talked to Gilad back in New York with an incredible interview that you're going to hear sometime in the coming weeks. And he has made an announcement today in their company that blows my mind, and it should everybody else's. Listen to this.
It's absolutely amazing. I mean, I think when people think about searching in genealogy, they always are like, well, I'll put in my name if I don't find a match. Now with MyHeritage's global name translation technology, you can actually put in a name and we'll translate it into Greek, Hebrew, Russian, Ukrainian, and then do the corresponding responses back. So it's amazing. You don't have to think.
Yeah, you don't have to speak the language. So for instance, if it scans maybe a newspaper article in Russian, it will take that, turn it into English for you, and translate the Russian name into its English counterpart.
Right. And with their international database, they have like over 6 billion family tree profiles on there already. This is going to start giving people many matches. So if you're a MyHeritage customer, your inbox should be changing very shortly.
It is an unbelievable thing that they're doing there. And of course, they've always been known for their technology. So congratulations to them. And this is a game changer.
It really is. You know, another exciting thing across the pond, over in Dublin, the National Library of Ireland has released over 400,000 images for free of Catholic parish registers. It's amazing. You'd have to go over to Dublin normally to look at the over 1,000 different Catholic parish records that ran from the 1740s to the 1880s, but now they're giving it for free. And
wow.
There's a reason behind that.
Which is?
You think about it. You find out where your ancestors in Ireland come from exactly, tourism will increase. So that's what their hope is, that more people will find their heritage, go over there, spend time, maybe go and visit the village where their family came from. So instead of going there, wasting your time in a library, which I don't ever think is a waste of time, this gives them a great chance to know where it is beforehand. So
isn't that something?
Exciting news.
It is exciting news. And you think about it, how many people in the British Isles have been denied access to records like that over the years for all kinds of different reasons? And now they're saying, oh, the heck with it. Here it is for the world. Come on over and see us.
We got to love technology. And on technology, speaking of things, if you were over there in Ireland or any place else, if you're able to copy microfilm over the years, you probably made printouts. But now with the technology on smartphones, whatever you're using, an Android, an iPhone, whatever, you can use your camera if you hold it steady enough. I find that using a flat screen microfilm reader, it's a little different on the slanted ones, but you can get a clear enough copy that you can either, one, post to your email, to send to a cousin that may be researching that, copyright restrictions, of course, taken into place, post it to Facebook or some social media, but it's a quicker way of printing it out, going home, putting it on your flatbed scanner, making a copy of it, and then putting it online. So it's one-stop posting. So that's great. Very excited to hear about Catherine Jackson, NEHCS member, and I always say that, you know, the more the merrier to share your story. So I hope some of the NEHCS listeners out there will take advantage and contact us at Extreme Genes with their stories, and who knows, they might hear them online.
Exactly. You can email me at fisher@extremegenes.com. You can contact us through Facebook or our extremegenes.com website.
Exactly. And don't forget Twitter.
Yep.
You can go to the Twitter page, too. The free database from NEHCS this week is kind of the next series of research. It's called the Early New England Family Study Project, and these are sketches that are going to cover New England families from 1641 to 1700. And we've put up a batch of new sketches, and those are going to be free release this week. And don't forget to go to the Extreme Genes Facebook and Twitter pages, or American Ancestors, or DL Genealogist on Twitter, to get all of the hyperlinks you need for any of the things we've talked about.
Boy, that is great stuff. All right, David Allen Lambert, he is the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors. David, always great. We'll talk to you again next week. Coming up next, we're going to be talking to our good friend Thomas McKenty. He is from Chicago. He's with High Definition Genealogy, and this guy has vision about what's coming down the pike with technology and genealogy. Wait till you hear what he's got to say. It's next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Hey, welcome back. You have found us, Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, talking to my friend Thomas McKenty. He is based in Chicago. Thomas, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
And, you know, I never have a conversation with Thomas when he doesn't get into some of the new technology that is coming out. And you know about things before anybody else for some reason. And I'm always excited to hear what you foresee coming down the road that's truly useful that you think we'll actually wind up using. What's on the agenda today?
DNA, one of the biggest things, I think that's rather stealth, which is going to surprise people when it gets in focus, is wearables. You know what a wearable is. It's like a Fitbit bracelet. It's
right.
Like Google Glass. We're going to see that over the next 5 years really start to influence the way we do genealogy research.
Now, how comfortable are people going to be with this, do you think?
That's the problem. That's why Google took Google Glass off the market, because the rule is right now is if the wearable is noticeable by other people, they sort of are repelled by it.
Hmm.
So that's why they're reworking Google Glass. But I think more and more people are using these Fitbit bracelets. I know as a baby boomer, I'm concerned about my health, and it gives me some great feedback.
Right. Now, talk about the feedback just with the health aspect of it, because
well,
I think people
aspect.
Might not be familiar with that yet.
Right. Well, the thing is, you know, you wear a Fitbit bracelet, it can calculate things like how many steps you take in a day. You can set goals. You tap into an app on your smart device as well, or an iPad, and it gives you feedback. But, you know, we're talking data here, and that is partly, there's a privacy concern, too. Who owns my data?
Wow.
I mean, this is data in terms of my blood pressure. It could be in terms of, is Fitbit going to sell it to an insurance company, and they're going to deny me insurance? I mean, there's all these privacy aspects we're starting to see with wearables.
Has there been any problem with that so far?
Not so far, but, you know, it's that big question mark. As more and more people embrace wearables, that's something that we need to look at, is who owns the data and who's going to be using it. I'm always concerned, and every genealogist should be concerned, when you sign up for any site, you should read the terms of service and know what people or what companies are doing with your data.
Right. Okay, well, let's talk about the application then for use in genealogy. What's coming down the road with wearables?
Well, with wearables, you could see a bracelet type or even a ring that would give you a notification. Let's say that bracelet, you could upload your DNA data. You've done a DNA test with Ancestry DNA or 23andMe. You've gotten the results. You've uploaded the data to the app. And it's then your bracelet might vibrate when you're within 300 feet of a third cousin because you both have been using that database. At a conference like Rootstech this past year had 22,000 people.
Right.
There's no way I could find a third cousin. You can't stand there in the expo hall and yell. But this way, it sort of says, oh, wow, someone is 100 feet away from me. I wonder who it is.
Now, that would have to be with somebody else also wearing the bracelet, right?
Exactly, and it also has to be permission-based. If I don't want to participate in that type of notification, maybe I just want to get an email that says, hey, I was at Roots Tech, and I think we're third cousins. You know, it's all about options and tailoring it towards the user.
And wouldn't you think, though, there's a certain limitation that would take place by the fact that it's new technology for some time?
Right.
A lot of people who do family history research are older and not comfortable with it. Many then wouldn't want to participate. So you really have a very limited view as to how that might work in terms of running into somebody. But it sounds like at least it's a possibility. It would be really interesting from that point of view.
And I think we'll see more embracement possibly with Google Glass, believe it or not. Google Glass, you wear this, over your eyes. It has an audio feature where you talk to it. You say, okay, Google. It works on wireless. And you could stand in front of a tombstone and say, okay, Google, pull up the family history record on Find a Grave for this person. And it would actually look at the tombstone, decipher, read the text, and pull up any existing record.
Wow. And then you could probably add to the record, right?
Well, that's it. Also, what if a record didn't exist on Billion Graves or Find a Grave? You can actually just stand there, and almost like you are a scanner, you would look at the tombstone, and it would add the record. It would take the GPS data, because it knows where you are physically located right then and there, and build a record.
Isn't that something? And post it online for the world to see.
Exactly. We're also going to see translation. We're going to see translation of documents. If I'm working in Germany in an archive on a German document, I can look at it through Google Glass, and it will actually superimpose English text over the German text. That already exists on Google Glass.
Is it adequate enough? I mean, there's many problems with translations of foreign languages.
It's Google Translate, and we all know if you speak a foreign language, it's not the King's English or the Queen's English that comes out as a result. But, you know, sometimes when I do research, all I need are those keywords to break through that brick wall.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. I deal with that a lot with German records online, and the German does not translate well at all.
Right.
French does better.
Right.
But it just seems to depend on the language. But I would imagine over time, all of that's going to improve as well. When you see some of the technology, like with MyHeritage and what they do and merging records and bringing it together, that kind of thing with language translation has got to come, and pretty soon, you would think.
Yeah, pretty soon. Also, we'll see handwriting, being able to scan handwriting and do that type of work, even with Google Glass, to look at a written diary and have it translated into typed text and sent to yourself via email. And these are tools that are going to be really important, because there's a lot of big data coming down the pike. More and more records are coming online, and we need ways to consume them quickly and efficiently.
We've certainly heard a lot more about the handwriting software that may be coming down the road the last couple of years. Have you heard anything further on that and progress and who's doing it?
Macaba was pursuing it, but of course they were bought out by Find My Past. But it was interesting. There was a German group that they were one of the finalists in the Roots Tech Innovator Summit this past year, and they already have, it seems, a very close technology. It's not perfect, but they seem to be one of the leaders in that area.
You know, it'll be very interesting when they get to things like the double S's that look like P's.
Yeah.
And how things like that get sorted out. In fact, I was talking to our friend Fred Moss the other day, and he was saying when he looks for his family, he has to look under indexing for not only Moss, but MOP.
Exactly. Right. You know, but the technology is getting better. I know I use Dragon, naturally speaking, dictation, because as I get older, my arthritis on my fingers, I just can't type as quickly as I used to. So I prefer to dictate some of my books, the initial draft. And now a lot of these applications have learning mode, where when I'm done dictating for a half hour, it will go back and it will learn how I pronounce certain words. So they're smart applications, and so we're seeing that more and more.
Isn't that going to be interesting when you combine that with the millions of records, the billions of pages that are going to be coming out over the next 5 to 10 years, how this is all going to come together?
Exactly. Exactly. As I think Jeff Rasmussen at Legacy Family Tree says, it's the best time to be in genealogy, right now.
Right now. That's it. You know, I was thinking to myself, I've done this for over 30 years, and yet if I had started just 7 or 8 years ago, I'd probably have everything I already have.
Exactly. You know? Sometimes I don't seem to want to seem like the grouchy old man who says, you kids get off of my lawn. But when I talk to newer genealogists that have only been in the sphere for 5 years, they don't know anything about sound decks.
Yeah.
or how we used to look up records. And I think that they're very lucky.
Yeah, they're very fortunate that way. I wouldn't trade in the experiences from the past, but you certainly can't go and say, well, we had it better back then when we had to work so hard. You know?
Right. I had to walk 5 miles and go up and down two hills to go get a census sheet. Yeah, you know.
Well, so. We did actually
we
in
did.
Some cases. You know, it's just the way it was. We're talking to Thomas McKenty, and Thomas, you've got an event, a course coming up here this fall that I'm very intrigued by. Tell people about this.
Yeah, I've been running every quarter, every 13 weeks. I've been running something called the Genealogy Do-Over. And it's for people like you and me that have been doing genealogy for 10, 20, 30 years. But, you know, we weren't using things like citing sources. We weren't following certain standards. We maybe were name collectors because that's what everyone did.
Right.
So in a way, this is a reset button. It's a reset button for your genealogy research. It's kind of radical. Basically, you start off by setting everything you've done for all those years aside. And I don't mean you get rid of it. I mean you put it aside. And you start with yourself. Now, isn't that what we say as educators?
Yeah.
A newcomer says, how do I start in genealogy? We always say, sit down and start with what you know. Start with yourself. So it's a 13-week program that starts with your own information and then goes from there.
And you know, this would be a fabulous thing if somebody was thinking of joining an organization like SAR, DAR, Mayflower Society, because every generation has to be proven to a certain standard. And that sounds like a great way to go. How can people find out more about that, Tom?
It actually has its own URL. It's just called it's called Genealogy Do-Over, www.genealogydoover.com. Or they can go to geniabloggers.com, and they can find more information.
And, you know, it's such a great idea because there's so many loose ends that people who started years ago. I'm still cleaning up mine from back in the 80s. You know, because when you start, you don't think about that stuff. You know, somebody else said it must be right, and you repeat it, and then you go back later and you find out, there's a problem here.
Yeah.
Thomas, thank you so much for coming on. Great talking to you, and I appreciate your vision. And let's talk again about the course in September.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thomas McKenty. And coming up next, we'll talk to a woman whose mother came from Ireland and passed when our listener was only 8 years old. What a journey to discover her mother's past and listen to the surprises all along the way. It's all coming up next in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, and always excited to hear from listeners that have a story, especially those who have gone to incredible lengths to find what they were looking for, and this person certainly fits that bill. Her name is Catherine Jackson. She's in Raynham, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. How are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm well. How are you? Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, tell us about this now. You've got quite a tale back there. You have a very mysterious mother. Tell us about her.
I do. Well, unfortunately, my mother had passed away when I was 8 years old, and there wasn't too much that was left behind with regards to her family history, as she was from Ireland and she had done some traveling in between. She had finally landed in Boston, Massachusetts, married, had me, and passed away when I was 8 years old. I know basically everyone had passed away in her family except for an uncle who I had tried to reach out several times but was unable to get in touch with him through writing letters through elementary and high school and all that. So I just kind of let it go. And all of a sudden, the internet became a thing, and I had found a website in which people were searching for people from the specific area that my mother was from, and I had made a post. And someone had said, oh, yeah, we know your uncle. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. And I kept in contact with that woman a little bit. And
isn't that great when volunteers come along like that and say, hey, I'm here to help no matter what?
Absolutely. And it was amazing because this was back in 2002 in which I had made that connection. And she was great because her mother and my grandmother were best friends.
Ah.
So now I was able to get some family history. So she kept in contact a little bit here or there through the years. And in 2010, my husband had surprised me with a trip to go to Ireland with my children. And our first stop was to visit the neighborhood that my mother had grown up in or had last lived in before she had moved. And that's when all these curious things started happening.
We hear that all the time.
Yeah, just one little spark, I think, really can make a huge difference. One little thing. So this woman had actually left the neighborhood and moved to New Zealand. And she had come back to visit the family the same time that I did. So I hadn't been back in like 35, 36 years, and she hadn't been back in 12. And this is when she was impelled to contact me and said, give me your phone number. And she called me, and basically we went through a whole bunch of stuff, and she said, I just want to let you know that your mother had another daughter.
Oh.
She lives in England. And, you know, I was sitting down, and I'm like, what? You know.
It's a good thing you were, Catherine.
I know. It was, and you know, it's just a magical electric shock. And I was just like, I need to find her. I need to find her. She said someone in the family had her contact information because she had left it trying to search for my mother 10 years prior. But she was very discreet about it, not wanting to hurt anyone or whatever, because now we're dealing with families being established.
Right.
And,
yes. And that's the tricky part of all of these things.
Absolutely. You don't want to hurt anybody, but you want to know two things. Who am I, and are there any medical concerns?
Right.
Those are the two issues that really make who you are, and you just want to be able to find out. And hopefully, you'll be able to connect. So again, through more curious circumstances, and England is great because they have everything right there. Their records are available, and they just have to have a mediator. So when my mother passed away, she had three or four pieces of paper that she had tucked away in her closet. And one day when I was a teenager cleaning it out, I found them. And it was actually falsified birth certificates and a visa application. And on that visa application, that's what I ran to get after this phone call with the woman. And it said where she lived in England after she left Ireland when she was 23 years old.
Okay.
Which would be when she had my sister around that time. So I went on to find mypast.ie, and there I found the birth record for my sister, but it didn't give the adoptive information. It just gives that there's a birth of a child to my mother, but I can't access that record.
Right.
So I ended up Googling all the adoption agencies in the area and in England, in the area and in Ireland, and 3 days later I got an email back. Dear Catherine, you'd be pleased to know we've positively identified your sister's adoption paperwork. And here I am at 40 years old finding out I have a sister for the first time.
Oh, where did it go from there?
So luckily, the woman who had told me that I had a sister in New Zealand was able to get in touch with her brother. And her brother the whole time had used the piece of paper that my sister had left with her identification information as a bookmark in his travel journal. And he pulled it out like he had it yesterday. So I spoke to my sister for the first time on October 10th of 2010, 10-10-10.
Did she know about you?
She, as it turned out, did know about me because she hired a genealogist in Ireland to try to trace her family. And she did locate my mother and did find out that she had lived in Boston. And my sister actually had the one thing that I never had, which was my mother's death certificate.
Ah.
So she was always about 6 months behind in trying to be able to reach me by sending letters. Again, being very polite and nice in the letter, just trying to find information without leading to the fact that there was an adoption.
Right.
At some point.
That had to please you, though, to know that you've got a sensitive sister there.
You know what? For me, not knowing a mother or having a family, per se, on my mother's side, not having the mother there, to actually find out that you have this sister who, when her adoptive parents had both passed away, that's when she initiated her search. So she was frustrated that things weren't going anywhere because she was hitting dead ends and not getting the responses that she wanted. So all of a sudden, to one day, pick up the answering machine and find out that here's this woman leaving this crazy, very pertinent voicemail.
Yes.
You know, with regards to everything. And, you know, to answer all of her questions the best that I could. And she had a slew of them, which was great. So to be able to answer all that, and then from there, we went on to the journey, because as I told you, my mother's birth certificate was also falsified because she was adopted.
Were you ever able to find where she was from?
I was able, through housing records, kind of being a little bit persistent, especially if you don't live in Ireland. A lot of people are very interested in Ireland, in helping people out in Ireland, especially Dublin, where my mother was from. Everyone knows somebody, and then they know somebody who knows somebody. So,
wow.
So many people reached out when I started posting on different websites for information. So from there, actually, one woman directed me to go on to Joe Duffy on RTE. And luckily, after I had given my family scenario, the information and the family names, one of my mother's adoptive family, it would have been her cousin, was listening.
Wow.
And
so you were on the radio there.
Yep. And I was quite nervous.
Well, you're not today, right?
Yeah, not today. I've become a veteran now. And she was listening, and she called in and said, I know her. That's my person. And they gave me her phone number, and I called her. And because I had already was able to find birth records and marriage records, I was able to validate the information that she was telling me, knowing that, yes, this was the family. And she had the first photograph and only photograph that I have of my mother at age 8. So that was just amazing to see. It was a family photo. And the Irish Archives, touching base with them and going there, I was able to get the information of my mother. She contracted TB from living in the tenement houses. So they gave me the admission date, the discharge date. So we were able to kind of do the chronology of her life to find out when it was, in fact, that she had left Ireland to go to England, doubled with the visa application and her steps that she took through everything. So I was actually, she left England to go to Australia. And from there, I had written to Australia to get her immigration paperwork. And it was 26 pages of everything about her. And in there, that's when I was able to find out when my mother found out when she was adopted.
Catherine, you are a great example of why you never give up and you have to keep pushing it and look under every rock. And you know what? There is a rock out there somewhere to look under that has exactly what you're looking for when all those weird things start happening, right?
Absolutely. I think it's just being persistent and not taking no for an answer, because there's a yes somewhere. It's just finding out where it is.
Are you having a great relationship with your sister?
We talk every day. We text every day, FaceTime. It's been very fulfilling, and it's filled a big void in both of our lives.
Congratulations. That's so exciting. Thanks for coming on Extreme Genes.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It is preservation time at Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. Hi, Tom. Good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Our email today comes from Brent Gibson in Edgewood, Washington. He said, Tom, I have some old postcards and photographs from the early 1900s that were laminated some time ago. Is it okay to leave them in the lamination, or is it even possible to get them out? Great question, Brant. What's the answer, Tom?
You know, that is a really good question. That's something that's really, really important, because back in the day, you laminated everything.
That's right.
You know, your kids' hand drawings or fingerprints, all kinds of stuff. You laminated everything that came down the road.
Even long before that, they used to cover autographed baseballs with some kind of protection.
Wow, I didn't even know that. You know, the thing is about lamination, there's good news and there's bad news. The deal with this stuff that this gentleman has, if everything still looks good, it's away from the sun, I would just leave it. I wouldn't mess with it. There's two basic kinds of lamination. There's hot lamination and there's cold lamination. Now, hot lamination, what it does is when they're laminating something, they're on these big cylinders, they get very, very hot. And the plastic, if it's at the right temperature, it actually melts together and melts to whatever's inside.
So it bonds with it?
Exactly. It's permanently bond if the temperature's right. You know, some people that don't do a lot of laminating, they just flip on the machine. They don't wait till it gets up to temperature and runs things through. It will just bond temporarily. Like I've got some old newspaper clippings of my dad that you can basically peel the laminating off. It sat so long, it's finally released the paper inside of it, and you can take it right off. Now, one thing, too, with the different kind of laminations is you want to get stuff that has a UV coating in it nowadays. In the old days, they didn't really know a lot about UV coating. They would hang pictures in their living room and wonder why this one has turned pink or purple or orange or something like that, because the dyes go away. And then the ones in the kitchen, why do these still look fine? They're the same photo. They were done at the same time. There are so many things that go into this. So what you want to do with your old ones, like I mentioned, if everything still looks good, just leave it that way. Keep them away from the sun or any UV lights. You know, sometimes even in your house, if you have a fish aquarium that has those purple lights, those really penetrate the water. That's a reason for that, to get rid of algae growing deep in your fish tank. So if you have a photo that's framed or in lamination that's sitting by that fish tank and it's getting those UV rays, those are more intense than the UV rays that are coming through your front window, and they will ruin stuff. So make sure if you have a fish aquarium like that that nobody would even think about, don't keep your photographs or newspaper clippings or anything near those, because it can actually ruin those and age them faster than the sun would.
I would have never thought of that. And you know, I've had a fish tank near my collection of signed photographs that have been fading somewhat for some time. Gotta go.
Yeah, it's gotta go. It's your fish's problem. We call him our fish wrangler that takes care of our salt water tank. And he's taught me a lot of stuff about this. And so I put two and two together and come up with four and thought, ah, that's why these things are fading. There's no sunlight on them. It's a kind of a purplish light in the fish tank that really keeps the fish living and their aquarium clean. So you got to be careful with stuff like that. Like you say, that's something you never think about. So back to the laminating itself. Now, the hot laminating is one kind. The cold laminating is the kind where it's basically just glued together and sticks to it.
And Tom, you're talking about now cold lamination. We mentioned the hot. How does the cold work?
Okay, well, cold is basically just loose adhesive is what I call it, because it doesn't have to have some chemical or heat reaction to make it sticky. It's sticky originally when you just pop it in. Now, one thing you got to be careful with cold lamination, basically it's you have one shot. If you lay it down and you get bubbles in it or it's crinkled or something, it ain't coming off.
Ooh.
So it's kind of nasty. The one nice thing about hot lamination is it usually goes through these big rollers and you kind of feed it through so the machine takes care of it. With the cold lamination, it's like putting a bumper sticker on a car. You kind of lift it up, you stick it in, start folding it down and running a credit card or something across it, and just hope that you have everything lined up so it's not hanging halfway out or it's getting wrinkles in it, which can really be a pain.
What's the advantage of cold?
It's a lot cheaper to do. A hot lamination machine are very expensive. A good one, you're looking at $1,000.
Wow.
Where cold lamination, you can run down to Office Depot or Office Max and just, you know, get cold lamination, stick your stuff in and reel it down. Now, you want to be careful. You always want to check on the grade of the lamination, if it has UV protection built into it, and things like this. If you're going to go the inexpensive way and you want to do the cold lamination, what I would suggest is when you buy the sheets, they're usually hinged at the top. I don't like those kind because it's easier to mess up. So I like to get the ones that are these separate sheets or cut the end of them off. And then when you open it up, then take your document or whatever you want to do the cold lamination. Don't start at the top or the bottom. Kind of just make a little light pencil mark where halfway through your sheet is and then where halfway through the lamination is. Then start at the middle, the very middle, and just get like a pencil and set it down there and then rub the pencil eraser softly across what you're going that will seal it right there in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And then you work from the middle to the bottom and the
right.
Middle to the top.
So it's shorter.
Right. So you're working with half a size.
Less chance of bubbles.
Exactly. A lot less chance of bubbles, less chance of getting it cattywampus. In fact, we actually call it hinging in the business. Like we do vinyl signs for people also for family reunions and such. And whenever we put a sticker on a window or on a door or anything, we start at the middle and work up and down, because instead of working with a 10-foot thing, it cuts it down into half.
So is there acid in these laminates?
There can be. Most of them don't have acids in them. Just always look for the seal that says that it's archival. And hopefully people nowadays are being a little bit more honest with that. It's kind of a self-regulated thing. Go with big companies when you're doing things like that, so you make sure you get the right one. Like USI has been supplying laminating equipment and supplies for years. They've been around and they've got a good reputation. So just read it, see what it is. And it's the same thing. More is not better. Don't necessarily get something, oh, wow, you know, this is 3 mil thick, or this one's only 1.5 mil thick. It must be better. Not necessarily. When you're working with the thicker stuff, like 3 mil, 5 mil, you're basically working with almost like a piece of cardboard.
Mm.
If it does get direct light, it can be like a magnifying glass.
Right.
And it'll actually ruin what you have inside of it. So kind of think of how I want to preserve this, why I want to preserve this. is this an original? Is this a copy? And going back to that, as we've talked about on many segments, always make a copy and use that to frame or laminate or whatever, and always keep the original in just a sleeve that you can put it in and out of, that you know for absolutely fact that it is archival quality.
And kept out of the light and in a drawer and in the dark somewhere.
Exactly. Away from heating ducts, away from AC ducts, all that kind of stuff. Keep your ducts away from your good documents.
All right. Keep your ducts in a row. Thanks so much,
exactly.
Tom. Good to see you. That wraps things up for this week. Thanks once again to Thomas McKenty from High Definition Genealogy in Chicago and his amazing foresight about what's coming down the road with genealogy technology. And to Catherine Jackson of Raynham, Massachusetts, and her incredible story of her research on her mother in Ireland and finding a half-sister in England. If you missed it, catch the podcast, extremegenes.com. Take care. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.